I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined again today by John Morgan, and we are going to be talking about the films of David Lynch. So, John, welcome back.
Hi. Great to be here, as always.
So, I thought what we would do in this session is bracket out certain things, like Lynch's shorter works, his earlier works, his student works, and also Twin Peaks and the stuff connected with Twin Peaks, because he is doing a new Twin Peaks series or a third season of Twin Peaks, and that's coming up. And I figured that maybe we should do a special session just on Twin Peaks when that's imminent. So,
which I think it's in about 3 months, isn't it? 2 or 3 months?
Yeah, which will give me enough time to grin and bear it and go through the second season of Twin Peaks, which was surprisingly bad. I rewatched it last year and I found it surprisingly bad.
It's okay until they solve the murder of Laura Palmer, and then it gets dumb with the Wyndham Earle stuff.
Oh yeah,
I would say.
Yes, the little pine weasel stuff and all that nonsense. It's really bad. So, yeah, we should do a special show on Twin Peaks before the new season comes out. But in terms of just one's overall take on Lynch, how do you rate him? What do you think about his work?
Well, I mean, for me, I wouldn't say he's my absolute favorite director. That would probably be Tarkovsky, but he's certainly in the top three or four for me, and with the possible exception of Kubrick, I think he's the best American director I know of. I just the first time I became aware of him was when I was going through a period where I was too snobby to watch television, so I missed all of Twin Peaks when it was first on, but for some reason I watched the very last episode. And even though I knew nothing about the characters or the story or anything, I mean, it's very surreal, and it kind of blew me away as a work of art, you know, of cinematic art. I mean, for television in 1990 or 1991, I think it was when the last episode aired. I mean, it was really something amazing. I mean, we've kind of gotten used to there being quality television these days, but back in the 80s and early 90s, it was still something pretty rare. So I resolved to see the whole thing, which I didn't get around to doing until a few years later. And then I was amazed by the series, at least the parts of it that Lynch himself worked on. He didn't work on every episode. And I worked my way through all of his films, and I just, there's both something very quintessentially American about Lynch, about his mentality. I also happen to think that he's in some ways a deeply conservative artist. And I don't mean in his techniques, which are far from conservative, but the way in which he views America and human nature, I think, are very much in keeping with the way a conservative tends to look at those things. And also, he's just a master at bringing psychological states to life on the screen. I really think in his work, he's going deep into the unconscious. I mean, you can feel it while you're watching it, that he's really delving in there, both into his own and into that of his audience, I think.
Right.
And I can't think of any other filmmaker that achieves that as well as he does.
I agree. I think he is one of the great directors living today, most definitely. He's certainly one of my... I think he's my favorite living director, without any question.
Yes, I think I'd agree with you.
I put him up there with people like Kurosawa and Ingmar Bergman, people like that, as one of the great directors in the history of cinema. I, too, think that he's fundamentally conservative in his outlook, but it's not a nicey-nice conservatism.
No.
His work for me, is unlocked by an essay by Flannery O'Connor, actually, that is in her collection Mystery and Manners. It's called Some Aspects of the Grotesque in Southern Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And there she basically defends her work from Catholic critics, largely, who think that if she's a Catholic novelist or a short story writer, that her stories should be full of exemplary characters, right? There should be good-hearted people who are struggling maybe with certain moral conflicts, and benevolent priests who help them through their troubles and hear their confessions, and there's a happy ending. And this is a kind of potboiler Catholic fiction that people think is exemplary and healthy, right? And a story about a family that gets murdered by a highwayman doesn't strike them as good Catholic fiction. It's not PG rated. It doesn't seem to have a happy ending. It seems like God is absent from the whole thing. And she defends herself by saying, look, what these critics are demanding is actually not Christian. It's sort of a modern bourgeois happy ending story. It's essentially progressivist and modernist. And she said that she quoted Thomas Mann, and Thomas Mann said something to the effect that the grotesque is the anti-bourgeois style. And by that, basically, she means that he meant this, and she takes him to mean this, that the bourgeois style is progressivist, right? It believes that all the evils in the world can be ameliorated through social progress and social engineering, right? If people just had more equality and more justice, there would be no evil in the world. We would all be living in a utopia of some sort. And for O'Connor, that is fundamentally wrong, because she's a Christian and she believes in things like original sin and evil are real forces in the world. And therefore, what seems grotesque to the modern bourgeois mind is actually the eruption of reality. It's the eruption of evils that cannot be ameliorated by merely social progressive means. And it's an eruption of human freedom, if you will, including the freedom to do wrong. And for her, it's also a sign that there's some kind of higher metaphysical order that's left out of the essentially materialist metaphysics of progress. And when I read that, I thought, you know, this is like Lynch. Because Lynch has this element of the grotesque that he's constantly throwing in our face. And it is deeply anti-progressivist. It's deeply anti-bourgeois. It's deeply realist in like a pre-modern realism about human nature and the potentiality for human evil. And also, there's an element of the supernatural in all of Lynch's work.
Yeah, which goes all the way back to Lovecraft and Poe, if we look at the American tradition. I think the thing is that Lynch's work, it's not this type of cinema of which, you know, we have all too much today, where it's grotesque for the sake of being grotesque, or it has this kind of nihilistic view of life. Well, you know, this is all that life really is. I mean, he's deeply dualistic. And I think he recognizes that inside each person, you know, there's a light side and a dark side that are at war with each other. I mean, you especially see that in Blue Velvet.
Right.
But I think it's in his other films as well. And I think it's just, he doesn't shy away from showing, you know, just how dark the dark side can get. But I never get the impression from his films that he thinks that, this is really the way things are. And, you know, this is human nature, you know, or, you know, that this is all that human nature is.
Right.
You know, he clearly thinks that we're capable of more than that.
He thinks that we're capable of being decent and good. It's just hard, right? And I think that one of the things that sort of leftists who watch Lynch do is they look at, say, the opening montage in Blue Velvet, where you've got the white picket fences and the flowers and the fireman on the fire truck waving as he goes by. And these people think that that is essentially fake and sinister, that world. And then, of course, you see the bugs down in the soil and everything, and they think that's reality. Reality is insects clawing and eating one another and all that other right. stuff, that suburban white bread stuff, that's all fake and sinister. That's not Lynch's view.
No, I don't think so.
Lynch believes that that white picket fence kind of world is genuinely good. He celebrates the virtues of ordinary conservative Americans. He celebrates that and thinks that life is good, but he realizes that it has to be defended
right,
from
yes,
darker things.
And that if we don't, that it will become those insects clawing all over each other.
Yeah, yeah.
In the dirt.
yeah, so exactly. So he believes that it's possible to create as much as you can, this kind of idyllic world, a world that makes you feel sentimental and innocent and everything. And yet he doesn't believe the underlying modernist metaphysics and morals of the natural goodness of man and things like that. He believes that there are really dark things. There are Frank Booths in the world. And yes. therefore, to create and maintain this sphere of goodness and wholesomeness, you have to have people who face outward toward all the dark stuff and battle it. And I look at Blue Velvet as a brilliant movie about a young man coming to realize that the idyllic world that he grew up in is surrounded on all sides by the potentiality for evil and chaos, and he becomes initiated into the guardians of society. The police, right? The police are the ones who guard society, but they also have to be guarded against because corruption creeps into them as well. But at the end, order is restored.
Yes.
The idyllic life is restored as much as possible.
And I'll just say, lest this seems like, to some people who are listening, like we're just going out on a limb here. There was a book of interviews with Lynch that came out in the 90s that I read, and he made a number of very, very clearly conservative statements in there, including one where he said that, he was really tired of crime in America. And he actually said, well, if it takes having a police officer on every street corner for 5 years, that's just what we have to do.
Right.
To stop crime.
Right.
So, I don't think it's just in his work. It's in his public statements as well.
Right. Right. And there's a symbolic correlation in Blue Velvet between the robins, which are a symbol of good, and the bugs, which are the symbols of chaos and disorder. And there's a scene where Jeffrey, who's played by Kyle MacLachlan, and his girlfriend, who's played by Laura Dern, are sitting in a car, and they're both just grappling with evil. They've seen things that they never realized could exist in their town, and Laura Dern is talking about this dream of and there's a church in the background. You can hear organ music playing out of the church. And she has this dream about the triumph of goodness, and it's symbolized by robins. And at the very end of the movie, the old aunt sees a robin on the windowsill with a bug in its beak.
And yes, they're combined at the end.
Yeah, and of course, and she says, I could never eat a bug. And then she pops something in her mouth that looks like a bug, which I always thought was fascinating. Like she's unconscious of that. And some people have remarked that the robin seems fake. It seems mechanical. But even if it is mechanical and obviously mechanical, the fact of the matter is that that could be part of the meaning of the movie, because there's an assumption here that that's being advanced that, yes, the triumph over evil requires artifice, right? It requires that we do something. That we create institutions, that we have guardians of society who fight against evil. And so, yeah, maybe the Robins are mechanical. Maybe they're an artifice, but they do maintain goodness.
There's a line in Lost Highway as well that I think it supports that, where when the two detectives come to his house, when they called, you know, to complain about whoever it is who's leaving these mysterious videotapes
right
on their front porch. And at the end, what's the main character's name in Lost Highway? I always have a terrible memory for names.
I can't remember. Yeah.
He thanks the police for coming. And one of the officers just says to him, well, that's what we do.
Right.
You know, and I was like, that's kind of like Lynch's view of them, I think, is like, you know, that's their role, is, you know, they're the guardians of society.
And this is especially underlined in Twin Peaks, where the sheriff's department and also the secret society, the Bookhouse Boys that the sheriff belongs to, are very much involved in a constant battle against evil, and not just petty crime, but supernatural evil.
Mm-hmm.
They're initiates, in some sense, into
yes.
the nature of reality. And there are truly dark forces in reality that take on a kind of supernatural, malevolent, metaphysical stance, status in Lynch's outlook.
That's probably, in Twin Peaks, that's probably where he gets into the most overt occultism, because, you know, a lot of his stuff kind of has that suggestion, but it never really becomes explicit. But in Twin Peaks, you can't really explain what's going on in any other way.
Right.
You know, except by, you know, believing that there's these occult forces at work. And I think that's partially Lynch, but also his collaborator, Mark Frost.
Right.
He wrote some novels, and in them you can really tell that he studied theosophy.
Yeah,
especially.
And he's done interviews on that too. He's been pretty open about that. The Black Lodge and the White Lodge stuff, that fits in with certain elements of theosophical myth.
Which actually comes from a novel by Talbot Mundy called The Devil's Guard. He was this, I can't remember if he's British or American, but about 100 years ago he wrote these sort of Indiana Jones type adventure stories. And he was a theosophist himself. He was actually a member of the society. And supposedly that stuff about the Black Lodge and the White Lodge was derived from a novel of his called The Devil's Guard. But I haven't actually read it yet myself, so I don't know. But I've read that at a number of places, that he got the idea from there.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Let's just go through things in chronological order to some extent, at least. We can always zigzag around. But Eraserhead is his first full-length film.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think when you first saw Eraserhead?
I was just blown away by it. I mean, I still think it's just a surrealist masterpiece. I think, you know, it's like going into a nightmare, of course, but like every single scene of that film, I think you could probably write an essay on. I mean, there's so much symbolism, both psychological and otherwise, in it. You know, it's just amazing, and it introduces a lot of the motifs, both visual and symbolic, that recur in Lynch's work in various forms, like the thing with electricity. He's very obsessed with that.
The flashes of light and electricity always seem to be connected with the supernatural in his cinematic language.
Yes, and I also think he's obsessed in some way with the idea of sin, and not necessarily in a Christian sense, but like at the beginning of Eraserhead, there's that mysterious figure who's called the Man and the Planet.
Exactly.
Who seems to sort of put things in motion. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought he was kind of a god figure.
Or a demiurge figure. Yeah, the way I look at Eraserhead is that it's a kind of Gnostic movie. It's a Gnostic anti-sex movie. In a way,
yes,
because
for sure.
there's a huge sense of sexual desire as a source of bondage and humiliation to the figures, and this baby is created, which seems like just a hypertrophied sperm cell or something. It's just grotesque.
And then becomes this enormous monster at the end.
Yeah.
After he tries to kill it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the man and the planet sort of, to me, he almost seemed like a symbol of bondage to the material. Right. He's like, he's inside the planet. He's inside the physical material world. And he's like engaged in like hard labor, right? Like pulling levers or something. I don't see them. He's like in charge of everything, but sort of enthralled to the entire material dimension of reality, and sort of shows up as a symbol of that kind of bondage. And that kind of dualism between the spiritual and the material is a realm of bondage, and sex is connected with the material, and it's just sucking you down into the material realm and the realm of bondage. It strikes me as extremely Gnostic in its outlook.
Yeah. There's the scene in the beginning is you see the man on the planet, and then you see Henry kind of floating in space, and he opens his mouth, and one of these weird sort of sperm-like creatures come out. And you could definitely, I think that's a reference to the fact that you find out in the movie that he's gotten his girlfriend pregnant. So right. It's obviously a reference to that. But I think it's also saying something about the connection between language and the original sin, because his student film, The Grandmother, starts out where there's this man and a woman in a forest, and they're sort of clutching each other and kissing each other. And all of a sudden, next to them, this boy is sort of like thrown out of the earth and lays there on the ground. And you find out later in the film that they're the boy's parents. And when they see him, they're completely horrified, and they actually try to chase him away. And I think this is some kind of it's Lynch's depiction of the original sin in the Garden of Eden, that, they were in this perfect state, but then, by submitting to the materialism of sexuality, they're sort of thrown out of Eden. Because, the rest of the film takes place in an extremely dark world.
Right.
So I saw Eraserhead as sort of a continuation of that, where, this original sin of Henry's kind of has this dual connotation of language and sexuality in a way.
Yeah, that's very interesting. What do you think about the figure of the woman in the radiator?
I'm never entirely sure what, I guess she's sort of, Henry's the name of the main character, isn't it?
Right, right.
So, yeah. I always saw her as like maybe something out of Henry's, like she sort of represents the part of Henry's subconscious that's still pure.
Yeah.
And, he's in this dark world and he's being manipulated by all these forces that he can't really understand. But, she's sort of like, maybe that's where he goes when he dreams or something like that. Because, of course, the last shot of the film is you're not entirely sure if he dies or what. But then he's in that room that seems to be all illuminated, like you can't see anything except light.
Right.
And she's there and he embraces her.
Right.
And then and there's sort of this angelic music around them.
Right. And the man and the planet blows up, right?
Yeah, you see, well, he tries to stop the machine.
Yeah.
Either that or the machine is breaking down. I've never been sure which. The one that he puts into motion right at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe the idea is that he's escaped from the material.
Yeah, I think that's what it represents.
And he's sort of united with Sophia, if we go with your Gnostic analogy.
I think that's sort of how I interpreted it, that she represents the spiritual principle in a way, and that there's a unity at the end there, which is his escape from the bondage of the material realm.
Mm-hmm.
I think he does kind of die too.
Well, I think I read, and I have to admit, I've read a lot of criticism on Eraserhead too, and I think that that's actually been established that that's what's going on, and you know that he sort of, well, some people have interpreted that end as a murder suicide, you know, that he kills his baby and then himself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to say because everything is so surreal. I mean, to say what is literally true and what isn't is kind of
right.
It's kind of difficult.
I mean, it's pretty dark because he does kill his baby and then, or tries to kill it, and attains liberation. If I were David Lynch's kids, I'd be a little worried by Eraserhead. I really would.
Well, I read an interview with his daughter once where she actually made a joke about that. It was such an experience growing up realizing that you were the baby in Eraserhead.
That's really funny.
But yeah, I think that kind of, because Lynch talks about how it was up until the time that he made Eraserhead, I guess he was really depressed and very paranoid. And it wasn't until he actually started practicing transcendental meditation,
mm-hmm.
which he still does, and actually he goes around the U.S. promoting it now. He attributes that to sort of, you know, developing a more positive consciousness. So I guess you could say that Eraserhead is a film made by a deeply depressed artist who hasn't quite found his way in the world yet.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And he was, you know, he was actually homeless at the time. He was actually living on the set. Because he invested all of his money into making the film. So I think he actually had to hide because he wasn't supposed to be there. So he had to like wake up really early to go out so that they wouldn't know that he was actually sleeping there.
That's amazing.
I don't know, but yeah, he's a really dedicated artist, you can tell. And then, that's basically all I was going to say about that. But
let's segue to The Elephant Man, then, his second film.
Which got made because Mel Brooks saw Eraserhead and loved it.
Yeah.
And basically hired Lynch to, you know, to do a more, you know, Hollywood-type film. Because I think Eraserhead was entirely independent. I don't think it had any studio backing.
No. Hence living in the studio, being homeless and everything. The Elephant Man was the first thing by Lynch that I saw, and I found it to be incredibly moving as a film. It's a movie about something grotesque, namely this poor man, and yet the entire story of it to me is about the triumph of human decency. It's got a sentimental quality to it, a very kind of Victorian moral idealism to it. There's no sense that the world is all a tidy place. In fact, there's a great deal of evil that has to be overcome. But in the end, these people triumph over a lot of over evil, and this Merrick character triumphs and is a decent human being despite his horrible disabilities. So it's very, very touching and essentially conservative, I think, in its outlook on morality, that there is a struggle against evil, and that one has to rise above this, but that it's possible for human beings to be decent to one another.
Yes. Yeah, I have to admit, I haven't seen that film in probably about 20 years. So if we do a pod on that one, I'll have to watch it again. But I did like it a great deal. And I remember there's all this symbolism with elephants. Like there's that strange sequence in the beginning where they're sort of running across the screen.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. I would like to rewatch it again. I love the movie, but it falls into that category of movies that I love but don't like to watch. For instance, Vertigo. Vertigo is my favorite movie that I don't like to watch. The Elephant Man is a great movie that I don't like to watch. The Christopher Nolan movie, The Prestige, is a very good movie that I do not like to watch. And on and on.
I know what you mean.
And part of the reason I don't like to watch it is it's so effective at manipulating my emotions that it's like it's exhausting. It's emotionally brutalizing to watch Vertigo for me. It's just so damn powerful to me. And yeah, the Elephant Man had that effect too.
Yeah, I'm trying to see what I do. I remember the basic story, of course, and I guess in terms of Lynch's body of work, you know, it does tie into some of his themes of the grotesque and the relationship between the grotesque and the, you know, the quote unquote normal world. Because if I remember correctly, he does sort of become, the Elephant Man himself sort of becomes a symbol for like what Victorian society wants to suppress, you know, Victorian London, which is where the film is set.
Well, I mean, he's exhibited as a freak, treated as sort of this abomination, but then it's discovered that he actually has a mind and a personality and moral sentiments and a certain amount of nobility. And when that's recognized, people rally to his aid. The crown princess, Princess Alexandra, makes an appearance at one point, in a very touching scene. And I was quite impressed by that. There was a lot of darkness in Victorian England, and before that, a lot of horrible exploitation, you know, and he's sort of could be sort of a symbol or a stand-in for all the dark and exploitative aspects of 19th century capitalism. And yet, there was this not leftist, but essentially the Christian moralism in of the Victorians that intervened. And you see that happening in the movie. So I thought it was very consistent with the other themes that you find in his work. It's kind of Christian. There's an element of Christianity, or if not Orthodox Christianity, a supernatural influx of grace in some sense that appears again and again. There are influxes of evil and there are influxes of good into the order in which we live. And they cannot be completely explained away by just sort of materialistic assumptions, right? It's like in Pulp Fiction where they're arguing, you know, it's God. God, you know, deflected those bullets. And the other guy says, no, it's a freak accident. Definitely, Lynch is on the side of there are supernatural things that happen. It's not all just freak accidents of the material cosmos, the little material, you know, ball bearings jostling with one another. It's more than that.
Yeah, although I also feel like when Lynch has those elements in his work, I agree with you. I think he does think that there are those things, but I also think he's pointing to the fact that our reality is also largely psychological. And, you know, I always get the feeling when I'm watching a Lynch film that you're seeing reality, you know, through somebody else's sort of, you know, mental view of things.
Right.
You know, because you're never seeing literal reality in a Lynch film. There's always a psychological element to it. And in fact, I think some of his films, like Lost Highway, I mean, I think most of Lost Highway is actually in somebody's head. I don't even think it's really happening. That's also true with Mulholland Drive.
Oh, yeah. That's Mulholland Drive, the way I interpreted it, and there's a review of it on the website. In fact, I think Mulholland Drive, the review I did of Mulholland Drive, was the first thing I ever wrote for a white nationalist website. And then I went on and wrote a lot of other stuff. But that was my debut. And most of Mulholland Drive is a dream. It's a wish fulfillment dream of a paranoid dying woman, is the argument that I made. But, the next movie he did, Dune, is in a way one of the least Lynchian movies, although there are elements of the grotesque in there that are not present in the novel. He really ups the grotesque factor with the Baron Harkonnen. And the big difference between the novel Dune and the movie Dune is that in the novel and the whole universe of novels, religion doesn't real. It's not real, as far as I can tell, in the mind of Frank Herbert. It's a mechanism of social control. Whereas,
yes,
at the end of Dune, Paul Atreides really has become some kind of messiah figure, and that is signified by a miracle. There's a miracle at the end where it rains. And that's not in the novel.
No, that's true.
So the supernatural element is real in Dune, the movie, but it's not real in the book. And that is definitely David Lynch imposing his views on this and wrapping up the story in a very different way.
Yeah, and well, also what you said about Vladimir Harkonnen is, in the book, the Harkonnens are still the enemies of House Atreides, you know, the main characters. But there's always this kind of suggestion in Dune that, you know, morality is more about power, and, you know, nobody is inherently good or evil. It's, you know, they're rivals. But essentially, the Harkonnens and the Atreides aren't, you know, that different in terms of their morality, you could say. And then Lynch goes out of his way to make Harkonnen look like this, you know, corrupt, degenerate, diseased figure. And also, I think the heart plug thing, that's not in the book, I don't think.
No, that is one of David Lynch's most horrifying inventions.
Yes. So, yeah, I in a way, you know, it fits it into this kind of dualism that you see in all of his films about the forces of chaos and darkness versus the forces of light. But it's, I think that the novel Dune is incredible, but I like the movie as well. I mean, it's probably his most flawed film.
I would agree.
Because as he himself has said, I mean, you know, he had made, you know, basically one art house film and then one, you know, kind of small scale studio film. And then all of a sudden he was put in charge of this huge Hollywood blockbuster production. and I think it got away from him a little bit, but there's still a lot of brilliant moments in that film. And I think the kind of dreamlike quality to it, which is enhanced by, Brian Eno's music.
Yes.
I've probably watched that, you know, 10 times at least. I enjoy it for all of its flaws.
I enjoy it too.
He was originally going to make, I think it was all 5 of Frank Herbert's Dune novels into films. He was actually under contract, but the first one did so poorly that he was actually released from it because they decided not to make the others. And I saw an interview with, well, but Lynch actually said he breathed a sigh of relief because then he was free to go and make the films he really wanted to make rather than.
Right. Yeah, it would have been.
But yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it would have been great if those were made, but maybe not by David Lynch. There was some discussion of David Lynch directing The Empire Strikes, not The Empire Strikes Back, The Return of the Jedi. Did you ever hear about that?
Yeah, I think I've heard that referenced. Yeah, that would have been. Well, it certainly would have been the best of the Star Wars films. Yeah. I have no doubt about that. But
yeah, I think it would have been. Imagine what he would have done with Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He would have made him into some kind of symbol of the unconscious evil or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it would have been a lot better film, most definitely.
I don't think Lucas would have liked it, though, most likely.
Probably not. One of the things about Dune that is with us today is its huge influence on the steampunk aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is a very positive thing about it. It really did influence that tremendously. The sets and the machines and things like that.
Yeah, it's, like Blade Runner did with cyberpunk.
Yeah, it's archaeo-futurist. I wrote an article about the archaeo-futurist elements of Dune. And I think that he captured that stylistically. You can't really figure out how some of the machines work, which is good, right? How do these things fly? It's not clear.
Well, how do they fold space?
Yeah.
That's never, they just, well, you apparently these creatures take this spice and then they can do it. But that, you know, it's actually, I would say Dune is almost closer to fantasy because.
Yeah. It's got magic in
what
it.
What science there is kind of marginal in the story, right. And it's more of a fantasy world.
Right. One of the things that Lynch did do in creating Dune is he took the audience scene with the guild navigator that takes place in the second novel, and he imports it into the first movie and uses it for exposition. And I think he did that simply because he wanted to show the guild navigator. He wanted to create that. He was fascinated with that monstrous fetus-like creature that these human beings were mutating into.
Don't they look a lot like the worms or whatever they are in Eraserhead?
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, there's the sandworms themselves, which there's actually a scene in Eraserhead where you see one of these worms kind of running back and forth across the screen. Mm-hmm. And then it finally, the top of it faces the camera and it opens its mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera goes into it.
Right.
And that's exactly what he ends up doing with the sandworms, you know, mm-hmm. 10 years later, if it was in Dune, except, you know, with like millions of dollars more in budget. Mm-hmm. But it's weird to me how all of his work fits together in this weird way, even though, you know, he could have had no idea that he was going to be making Dune. I think he said in interviews he hadn't even heard of the book before he was hired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's that strange connection between the worms and Eraserhead and the sandworms. What else would you say is especially Lynchian in the film?
Well, he definitely heightens the grotesque. There's a dualism there that enters in. There's an element of the real supernatural that comes in. We've talked about those.
Well, here's something that quite obvious is that the aesthetics of House Atreides are so fascistic.
Yes.
And, you know, I've watched the film with people who, you know, aren't from our circles, have no particular interest in fascist aesthetics, and even they comment on it.
Yeah, but that's actually very much in keeping with Herbert's original vision. And in some of the later Dune novels, this is quite interesting, he said that what distinguished House Atreides from the other houses, except maybe Corino, the Imperial House, which was their main rival when you get right down to it, was that they were absolute masters at commanding the loyalty of men. They were absolute masters of creating fanatical bonds of loyalty. And the example that Herbert offers is the SS.
When did he use that example?
It's in one of the later novels.
Okay, I haven't read all of them.
So there's there are a total of six that he finished, and it's in maybe the third or one of the last three. I don't remember, but I think it might be in the third novel. But I thought that was really fascinating. That was the example that he reached for in explicating the secret of the Atreides. This was what they mastered the most. And of course, there's also this sort of idea that they're descended from the house of Atreus, right? The house of Agamemnon, which I thought was really kind of fascinating. Interesting mythology there. But Their art was the art of the SS.
Yeah, that's. I'll have to go and read the rest of the books then.
Yeah,
they, I only read the first two.
The third one is a superb book, actually, and the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries that was done of Dune,
yes,
was somewhat flawed. It irritated me, but for one thing, they had a lot of just ugly people in the cast. It just didn't appeal to
me. Well, Sci-Fi Channel, that's all they could afford.
Yeah, but what they did is that they did a sequel series that encompasses Dune Messiah and Children of Dune into a single story. And they switched some of the cast, and they also changed directors and set design and production design, and significantly improved it. And I just thought it was extraordinarily well done and really told that the story of those two novels quite effectively. So it's really worth seeing.
Okay, yeah, I've never watched those, I have to say. I always heard that they weren't that great, but...
Well, the Dune one wasn't that great, but The Children of Dune, which encompasses also the second novel, Dune Messiah, is really quite good. I was really impressed. I think the name of the actress is Alice Krieg or Kriega. She was the Borg Queen in some of the Star Trek stuff. She plays...
She's also in Barfly, based on the Bukowski story.
Yeah, I've never seen that, but she plays Jessica, the mother of Paul, and she's just superb in it. She looks the part. And the other main cast members are really well cast, and they really look the part. It's just a very well cast thing. The aesthetic is kind of, and I think it works. It's kind of British, British Empire aesthetic in certain ways, the way that the royals are shown, sort of early 20th century British Empire. And it's well done, and it's definitely worth seeing.
Okay, yeah, I'll have to check that out. I wouldn't be surprised now that, ever since Lord of the Rings, we have all these fantasy series coming out, if somebody dusts off Dune decides to do a whole series of those.
I wish somebody would do all six of the books, frankly. Although, it would be a bit of work to turn those last two books into a good movie. And I think, actually, they could be turned into a single very good movie. There's a lot of blubber that needs to be cut out and boiled down and gotten rid of in those books. But I think they could be tightened up into an actually pretty good single film. There's some interesting, truly grotesque and horrifying ideas that are put forward in there. In those last two novels, you learn that two very disturbing things become quite foregrounded. One is that the Jews are still with us, even in the far, far future. And the other is, far more powerful than the Jews and more prominent than the Jews, Islam is still with us. And of course, that's all sort of hinted at here and there in the earlier
novels.
Well, yeah,
they use jihad and all these other Islamic terms.
The Bene Gesserit, the Bene Tlilax. And it turns out that the Bene Tlilax civilization is kind of a form of Islam that heightens the Islamic objectification and repression of women to the most grotesque and absurd extreme, and then gives rise to an equally grotesque and horrifying reaction in the form of this group called the Honored Matres, who are the big enemies. So the guy had a really interesting imagination. And a lot of the stuff that he thought up is very politically incorrect by today's standard, most definitely.
Well, you said that the Jews are in this world. Surely he doesn't actually call them that, though.
Oh, yes, he does. He calls them the Jews.
Really?
Yeah. They're Jews, yes. they're still around, and they're hyper-secretive and clannish. And basically he's examining the traits, the social traits necessary for extremely long time horizons. And I mean, that's one of the underlying things that animates the entire Dune series, is what form of government, what form of society, what kind of religion, what kind of psychology is consistent with the extremely long time horizons necessary for man to go out and colonize space. And of course, his mind falls on the example of the Jews, because they've been around for a very long time. So they don't play a huge role, but they are there. And
it's interesting.
But, you know, the initiatic kind of orders associated with Islam, like Sufism, are also there. But they're mutated into something truly monstrous. Monstrous in ways that I don't even want to talk about. I don't want to spoil it for people. So maybe those movies won't be made. Well, in the age of Trump, maybe they will. That's an interesting possibility.
Well, you mentioned politics, and I'm no expert on Herbert, but I did read an interview with him once where he was asked about the fact that, you know, the civilization, the sort of, you know, galactic civilization of Dune is so medieval European in its conception. And Herbert just said, well, you know, I think that feudalism is the best political system, you know, that man has ever developed, and that, you know, we're inevitably going to go back to that.
Yeah.
He was quite blatant about that in the in this interview. I thought that was interesting.
That is
interesting. He didn't say, like, oh, I thought it would be, you know, it would be interesting to have medieval stuff in the future. He actually said, no, that's the best system. So
something like it is going to happen if we actually are to go to the stars.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, it's not going to be like Star Trek, I hope. That would be, you know, the intergalactic United Nations.
Lots of, you know, intergalactic Peace Corps, intergalactic do-gooders.
Yes, NGOs. And
yes, yes. So,
well, we're getting a bit far afield from Lynch.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it is Dune. So let's talk a bit about Blue Velvet.
That's, except for Eraserhead, that's definitely my favorite Lynch film. In fact, I'd probably put Eraserhead and Blue Velvet equal. I don't know that I could say that I like one more than the other. We said a bit about it earlier, but it's just, I feel like that's the summation of Lynch's worldview is in that film.
I agree.
I think the, you know, sort of the daytime world of the white picket fences and you know, family life and so forth. I think that's actually Lynch's ideal. And, you know, as you said before, you know, being at war with this, you know, underground dark world that's always threatening it. I think if you see that, you pretty much understand everything about Lynch's worldview. And there's also that idea of, about sexuality that you mentioned, like that when Isabella Rossellini shows up at what's Kyle MacLachlan's name in the film?
Jeffrey.
When she shows up at Jeffrey's house near the end, and she tells Laura Dern, who's Jeffrey's girlfriend, he put his disease in me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's I actually sometimes think that actually is how Lynch sees sexuality.
Oh, I think so.
you know, it's because it's in that film too. Like, there's that scene where Jeffrey and Isabella Rossellini are having sex, and he sort of overdubs these
animal sounds,
noises,
yeah,
in the background. I mean, it's not depicted as something good.
No. No, it's
and Laura Dern is sort of the wholesome. I mean, I don't even think they kiss in the film, or maybe they do, but there's certainly nothing sexual.
Yeah.
In their relationship.
Yeah.
Which I guess in to Lynch's mind, you know, that should all just, you know, be kept off screen.
Right.
I'm hard pressed to think of anywhere where sexuality is depicted in a good way in a Lynch film.
Yeah, the character of Frank Booth is one of the most terrifying characters in film.
Yeah. He's very, I mean, you know that there are people like him out there. That's what's scary about him to me.
Yeah. Yeah. He is the king of the nighttime world and incredibly vicious, destructive force of chaos.
Self-destructive as well.
Self-destructive and probably sexually impotent too.
Yeah.
That's strongly hinted at in various ways, which is why he's so violent and sick, you know, sadistic.
And he says, fuck.
Fuck all the time. I'll fuck anything that moves. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right, Frank. Yeah.
Or that toast, here's to your fuck.
Here's to your fuck, Frank. Yeah. Yeah, that is one sick, dark character.
Yeah, well, and all the daddy shit, you know, that he goes into.
Yeah.
That's really disturbing. I think of some other podcast you and I did. I remember you talking about the fact that was probably and I think I've read this in some criticism about the film as well, that there was – that you could interpret the scene where Jeffrey sees – Frank come in and Isabella Rossellini is there and he insists that she referred to him as daddy. And yeah. You know, he said, well, you don't know if they're actually having sex or he's just sort of miming having sex.
Oh, it doesn't seem like he's doing anything but kind of miming it. And, yeah. And he's like the child. I mean, I sort of saw that as
his parents.
Yeah, he's the child hiding in the closet watching his parents having sex,
mm-hmm.
which is truly, truly a sick thing. But you sort of get your first ideas about what's going on in the sexual realm from your parents. You pick up clues about this living around the house. So I guess it's not that aberrant and weird, but yeah, it's definitely this weird voyeuristic
thing. The whole film is. I mean, people are hiding in closets like mm-hmm. half of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
well, there's all that. You kind of get the feeling that, I mean, Jeffrey is this young guy. You know, he's probably 18 or 19, and he's obsessed with, you know, sort of exploring the dark side of his town, which you could kind of see as symbolic that, you know, he wants to explore his sexuality, because there's that scene where one of Frank's gang members asks him if he's been to Pussy Heaven.
Yeah.
And he says no. So you kind of get the feeling that this is the way that Jeffrey loses his innocence. Well, he finally does have sex with Isabella Rossellini.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So it's about him losing his innocence, actually.
Yeah.
Although he manages to make it back to the world of the light at the end, but I guess the symbol of the bug with the bird in its mouth suggests that rather the bird with the bug in its mouth kind of suggests that he's back in the world of the light, but it's not quite as pure as maybe he saw it.
Exactly. He's returned to it with a sense of how contingent it all is and what's necessary to maintain it. But mm-hmm. his father's out of the hospital. His family and Laura Dern's family are together. You see Isabella Rossellini reunited with her little boy. So it is a genuinely happy ending, but it's a happy ending that we now realize has to be won in this, not just physical battle with evil, with the police, but a kind of metaphysical battle. And one of the things that you see with the appearance of Frank Booth is, again, in the apartment, you've got these dark curtains, you've got radiators, and you've got flickering lights and electricity. And these mm-hmm. things are all associated in Lynch's visual language with the supernatural, in this case, the demonic. And when Jeffrey kills Frank, it cuts to a light burning out, surging and burning out. And again, I think it's not just the death of a physical body. It's something else is being intimated there. So yeah, there's a metaphysical battle with evil that has to take place.
And psychological, I think, too.
Exactly, because you're struggling within yourself, too. Exactly.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he experiences that. I mean, she, you know, that their sex, she's saying, hit me, hit me. And he finally hits her, and then it sort of explodes, right? That's not a pleasant feeling for him. You know, he feels terrible about that. But at the same time, you know, he realizes that there's sex and violence are very much entwined with one another.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of his. Well, I think that that's something in America, you know, in American culture that we still kind of struggle with is, you know, that there tends to be this idea that, well, there's, you know, there's sort of this sweet, innocent sex and there's this, you know, weird, bad sex. When, you know, the truth is that, you know, it's always mixed. I mean, it's not, yeah, that's kind of, I think that goes back to Americans' kind of puritanical holdovers.
Right.
As it were, you know, this idea that, well, you know, there's, well, you know, sex with your wife, with procreation, that's always for procreation. That's nice and pure. But it's, I guess in Blue Velvet, that's the impression that you get that that's the kind of sex that Jeffrey and Laura Dern are going to have.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's truly an extraordinary film. I must have watched it 20 times. I've seen it on the screen a couple of times. I've seen it on VHS. I've seen it on DVD. I've seen it on Blu-ray. And I keep coming back to it because it's just so powerful.
Yeah. No, that's definitely, well, I wouldn't put it in my top 10 films, but it's probably in my top 20 favorite films of all time. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's definitely up there, though.
I
think it's the most definitive statement of Lynch's own worldview.
I would agree. Well, hey, let's wrap this up because we've been going on for more than an hour. So why don't we just next week start over with the same topic, and we'll talk about Wild at Heart, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, The Straight Story, and Inland Empire. And that'll give me a chance to rewatch Inland Empire. I have to admit that I've only watched that once, and it was a big disappointment to me.
Oh, I liked it, but it's, remember what you said before about films that you like but you don't want to watch?
Right.
That's how it is for me, and I have to admit I'm actually dreading having, I saw it once in the theater when it first came out, and I have not seen it since, and I will watch it again before we talk about it, but I know I'm kind of dreading it at the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's dark, dark. I mean, there's some scenes in there that I think are probably darker than anything else that Lynch has done.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. For me, it didn't come together. I couldn't come up with an interpretation of it. And I kind of pride myself on the fact that I think I've been able to figure out things like the plot of Lost Highway and the plot of Mulholland Drive, which isn't an easy thing to do, and Inland Empire perplexes me still. So I need to take another bite.
We can wait to talk about it, but I actually think he uses, in my view, the same trope in Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway and in Inland Empire, but we can wait till we have our full discussion until I explain what I mean by that. But I think structurally those three films are very similar.
I would agree. Well, John, this has been really interesting, and it's made me want to get some David Lynch films off the shelf and rewatch them for next week. So,
yeah, I'm going to do that.
So let's just continue this conversation in a week's time.
All right. Sounds good, Greg.